You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered, and solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. This is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone, and we want to remind you that if you if you have to stop listening to this, or if you want to hear it again, or if you want to tell your friends about it to hear it, you can catch us on Monday morning, 8 a.m.
And if you aren't in our listening area, you can tune in live stream at kruufm.com and also check out our website, writersvoices.com, as well. So, Mom, what do we have in store for our listeners today?
Today we have a most interesting book. It's called Eggshells. And Katrina Lally is the author. And I mean, it is a most interesting book. I've never read anything quite like it. Katrina studied English literature at Trinity College, Dublin, and has had a colorful employment history, working as a copywriter, a home helper in New York, and an English teacher in Japan. She has traveled extensively around Europe, Asia, the Middle East, and South America, and currently resides in Dublin. And this is where, this is the setting of the book, is Dublin.
That is true. And Eggshells is an Indie Next selection, an Irish Book Award finalist, a Library Reads pick. So it has been getting a lot of attention. And welcome to Writers' Voices, Katrina.
Thanks, Monica and Caroline. It's great to be on here.
And you're calling us from Dublin. Is it raining?
No, actually, it makes a change for Ireland, but the sun is shining here.
Well, we have the overcast and rain here today, so.
Oh, okay. Bummer.
Yeah. I mean, Dublin is that your hometown?
It is, yeah. I was born here and grew up here and studied here, and I've gone traveling various places, as you mentioned, but I've always come back to Dublin.
It seems like Dublin is the place to set unusual stories. Would you? And I would say that Eggshells is an unusual story. Tell us what inspired you to write this novel.
Okay, so I think for me, it just happens to be set in Dublin because that's my hometown. I didn't really realize the kind of the implications of setting such a strange novel in Dublin when I wrote it. So I was laid off from my job in 2011, so it was the height of the recession, and I found myself unemployed in Dublin and kind of just walking around job hunting and not having any success finding a job. And so this character of Vivian came to me, this outsider character, because I felt pretty much like an outsider that year and just kind of, you know, I was part of a group and then suddenly I was excluded from this group and I felt kind of aimless, I suppose. So I was walking around Dublin and then I started noticing these street signs with letters missing. And I started writing them down in my notebook and wondering what these new street signs spelled. Do they spell new places? And then the voice of Vivian came to me, this creature who's looking for a home. So Vivian believes she's a changeling, that she was replaced by, or she's a fairy child who'd been left in the place of a human child. And so Vivian is wandering around Dublin looking for a portal to this other world and kind of looking for a place to belong. So I suppose this, like, it's really about an outsider character, and it was me feeling like an outsider that year that really inspired the book.
Mm. Now, this is your first published novel, is that true?
Yeah, it is. My first published anything, actually. I hadn't had anything published before this, so it was really a huge deal for me.
Wow. So how did you come to writing? Have you always written, and or did you just start at this time, or what was your history with writing?
Yeah, I've always been interested in writing and reading, but it was for myself. I hadn't really realized that I could write a novel that would get published. So just before I got laid off from my job, I did a creative writing course, and I just really decided I wanted to try and write a few short stories. And the creative writing course was excellent for helping me to kind of just put my thoughts down on paper and not think too much about it and just to throw something out there. But I had no success with short stories, and I tried to get them published. I entered competitions, but it was all kind of... This was coinciding with the time I was unemployed then, so there was kind of constant rejections for applying for jobs and trying to get short stories published. So then I thought, well, I'll try my hand at a novel, because a novel is a long kind of project, and I felt that even if there was rejection at the end, that I would feel I'd accomplished something, like something long, like running a marathon, that you feel even if you've done it, you don't have to win it, you just have to do it to feel like you've achieved something. So that was my project that year I was unemployed. But funnily, I did most of my research that year while I was wandering around Dublin. I took all the notes of places I visited and wrote lots of character sketches, but I didn't actually start writing the novel until I got a job, exactly a year later, until I started a basic kind of data entry job. And I think that gave me the confidence to start writing again.
Oh, that's interesting. So what was your like writing process like? Did you write before work, after work, weekends, every day, just when you could?
Yeah, pretty much. At the time, I was working a 12 to 9 p.m. shift, which was kind of awkward for having a social life or doing things. So I wrote before work and after work, and I really wanted to get this thing done. So I took that advice. I don't know who came up with this, but somebody came up with 1,000 words a day, and I stuck to that pretty rigidly. And I threw it out on the page. And it came quite easily because I had notebooks and notebooks and notebooks of stuff. It wasn't like trying to invent something new every day. So I had all the kind of the research and the dialogue. Like, a lot of it had been actually concocted beforehand, which made it easier to put it together.
Well, this is a very... Vivian is a very interesting character. And the kind of life that she has to live and seems to enjoy living.
Give us like a brief description of who, I mean, you told us about Vivian thinking she's a changeling, but like, tell us a little bit more about her, about where she is at the beginning of the book.
Okay, so Vivian was living with her great aunt. And her great-aunt has died and left Vivian the house. So the great-aunt, for some reason, collected chairs, and there are chairs all over the house and lots of stuff, I suppose. There's kind of a sense of hoarding and claustrophobia. And Vivian's looking through her great-aunt's bookshelves, and she finds an old map of Dublin. And in the index at the back, she finds all these magical-sounding places, place names. So these are place names that genuinely exist in Dublin, like Scribbles Town, Yellow Road, Emerald Street, Middle Third. And she writes a list of these places and decides to go and visit them all and to make a map of the places she visits. And she's trying to find this portal. So she thinks even if she doesn't find the portal when she reaches this street or this destination, that maybe that the pattern of the maps that she makes will explain things to her or will give her some kind of a meaning. So that's her situation. She's also jobless, but I very deliberately didn't want her to be obsessively job hunting as I was. So I gave her kind of no financial worries, because at the time I had, you know, a mortgage and I was trying to pay bills while I was having a job. And I wanted Vivian to not have that stress, to have no financial worries. So she muddles through life. She seems to have money somewhere because she doesn't have to really job hunt. She half-heartedly tries to do it because she has social services coming and checking and making sure that she is job hunting.
Well, her parents had told her that because she was different, that she had probably been left there by fairies, right? So that kind of gave her that whole, you know, I'm different. Aurora about it, and she thought, oh gosh, how different am I? Where did I come from? You know, I can see how that would confuse her.
Exactly, and you know, that came from, like, I was always interested in the idea of changelings as kind of the ultimate of not belonging. Like in Ireland, centuries ago, people sometimes explained children who weren't behaving, you know, normally, in quotation marks, they would explain that as, oh, the fairies must have come and taken the real child, and they put in this changeling child. So I wanted to take that to extreme. I don't go into the childhood much. There's various mentions throughout the book, but I don't go into it in detail because I wanted Vivian to kind of repress this traumatic part of her past and mm-hmm. just try and push forward and push on ahead and figure out where she belongs without thinking too much about how she came to believe this. But the idea did come from her parents.
Now, Katrina's behavior is bizarre in a lot of different ways, not just that she thinks she's from the fairies. And is it hard to, like, put yourself in the head of somebody who is so odd?
Well, it was bizarrely easy to do. A little worrying, maybe, about my own character. I think I took situations where I would act very normally and act according to social rules, and I would just play around with them and see, well, what would you do if you decided to say the wrong thing in this context? Mm. Or I think Vivian as well, she takes a lot of language, she takes things very literally, and that's where some of the very awkward moments come from. She's not very good at small talk with strangers, so there's more awkward moments there. And she mostly kind of tells the truth, I think, which gets her into trouble because, well, yeah. We don't really tell the whole truth all the time in social settings.
Well, I was interested to see, too, that some of the people that she interacted with, store clerks and so forth, were really kind to her. They, you know, they realized that she was different, but they didn't make fun of her. They were kind of go along with things, and I thought that was nice.
Yeah, and I think in real life that happened. I mean, because I spent a lot of time kind of walking around Dublin and getting buses, and you see people like slightly like Vivian, kind of misfits who don't fully belong or who are starting conversations but acting a little bit strangely. Mm-hmm. I think most people seem to kind of humour them and are quite kind. I mean, the book too, sometimes it just gets too strange, even for the kind, generous people, that the Vivian takes things a little too far, and then things get awkward.
Yeah, right.
By the way, Caroline pointed out to me that I misspoke a little bit ago and called the character by your name. I apologize for that.
That's okay. I'm interchangeable at this stage.
You know, Vivian seemed to me like she's on what they call on the spectrum, that she has Asperger's or something like that. Did you do any research into that?
No, I didn't. And strangely, again, at the time when I was writing, I just wanted kind of the voice of a misfit character, of somebody who didn't belong. I didn't think about any kind of a condition. But then when the book got published and people started reading it, and then I visited some book groups who had read it, and people started asking me, yeah, is she on the spectrum? Does she have Asperger's or autism? Some people wondered if she had OCD. PTSD was another one that people thought she might have, or mm-hmm. manic depression. So a lot of conditions like came up that I had not even thought about. I'm kind of glad I didn't, because if I had diagnosed her with something, I would have had to research it and stick rigidly to, you know, to the kind of symptoms of that condition. Mm-hmm. So I think, to me, Vivian is just, she's somebody who's quite eccentric and she sees the world differently. And maybe partly that's her own personality, partly that's probably her upbringing. But we're never really sure you know, if she has, like, she might have some condition, but it's not something that that I came up with.
Well, she's a free spirit. There's no doubt about that.
Now, I think the reason that this book has attracted so much attention and you know, you've gotten these awards and is, you know, beyond having, or at least one of the reasons, beyond having an interesting and a unique concept, a really vivid character, your use of language is just charming. And the way that you or Vivian through you describe things, there were just like on every page, there's a sentence that makes me stop and think, oh, I never would have looked at it that way.
Oh, that's lovely to hear.
Yeah. I mean, I could open to any page, I think, and I'll just, for example, okay, so I just opened to a page, and here is a man who is on the phone on the bus that she sits next to, and she describes him. He talks like he's being chased by words, swallowed up by sentences. It's such a unique way of describing something. How did you develop that ability?
I think with Vivian, I probably inhabited her character so deeply that I started to look at Dublin and its characters and people extremely differently. I try to look at them with completely fresh eyes. So Vivian has quite a childlike way of looking at the world. Like things, because she doesn't really have friends or social interactions, the way people deal with each other is quite new to her. So I wanted to try and examine normal enough situations, but through the eyes of somebody who wouldn't understand them as normal. So, and a lot of those situations, like that one in the guy on the bus on the phone, a lot of those are real things that I witnessed or was involved in those conversations. You know, people looking for money, or there's another situation where I have, in the book, I put it down as a woman, but in reality, an old man came up to me and asked me where would he buy shoes, that he was going to meet the president for lunch that day, and where could he buy cheap shoes. And we had this great discussion about where the best place would be to buy shoes. And I wasn't quite sure if he was meeting the president, but then it became clear that he wasn't he wasn't quite sure what he was doing that day. But I took those actual occurrences or overheard conversations and kind of put them into the book, but tried to see it through the lens of somebody who just isn't quite familiar with social interaction.
Mm-hmm. Wow. As you were writing, Katrina, did you tell us a little bit more about the writing process? So in doing these descriptions, would it take you, like, would you come up with all these unique ways of describing things in a first draft, or were you adding things later? Did you rework sections? You know, I'm just...
Yeah, mostly... A lot of stuff was in the first draft, because I would have these like overheard conversations written down, and then in the first draft I would try and piece together Vivian's reaction to them, or her walk. So I had the walks all mapped out, and I did what Vivian did. I traced out those maps, you know, plotted them on a map and traced them out onto parchment paper and tried to figure out what shape they represented. So, like I said, because I had all that kind of research done, the job of actually writing was so much easier. And then I could kind of get into the character of Vivian and slot in these phrases and things. I mean, I probably wrote way too much, I think, in my writing 1,000 words a day. I deleted an awful lot of that, and I wouldn't edit as I go along. I decided to just keep the novel pushing forward and keep the momentum going, because I wasn't quite sure. Like, I knew what walks she would go on, but I wasn't quite sure where Vivian would end up. So I wanted to just keep trying to get to know her and figure out her motivations. And So I did a lot of deleting. I still have a file on my computer somewhere because I couldn't quite quite cope with just deleting everything, but I just put all the stuff that I didn't use into this other file. So that's somewhere on my laptop now. I'll have to have a look at it and see what I left out.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Katrina Lally, author of Eggshells, a novel, which has been described by The Guardian as inventive, funny, and ultimately rather moving. And from Kirkus Reviews, this urban fairy tale delivers something that is both subtle and profound in its examination of the human soul. Magically delicious.
So, yeah. So how did you choose the title, Eggshells?
I like the idea of somebody walking on eggshells, even if, like, Vivian isn't quite aware sometimes she's walking on eggshells in conversation, but she's sometimes she's oblivious to the awkwardness around her.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a traditional old Irish method of discovering a changeling or kind of returning a fairy child and getting the human child back, which is brewing eggshells in a pot. And the real child is supposed to come down the chimney. So there's an episode in the book where Vivian attempts this with her friend Penelope. And, of course, everything, like, Vivian tries to kind of to use old Irish mythology or fairy tales, but they're mostly from centuries ago in rural Ireland. And she attempts to kind of transplant them onto contemporary urban Dublin, which doesn't quite work. So I think she thinks that the real child will come down the extractor fan rather than the chimney because she doesn't have a chimney.
Oh, and there was one scene where she's trying some ritual that is supposed to involve throwing a or burning a cow or something, and so she throws hamburger patties into the fire.
Yeah. That never quite works. And then she's looking for a holy well one day and she only finds kind of disused public toilets. So she has to just make do with, you know, what exists in urban reality rather than this kind of mythical past.
Wow. Well, Katrina, why don't you read to us from Eggshells?
Okay. I think I'll read a section. I like this section because it was, as we were talking about earlier, it was kind of inspired by something, a conversation in a supermarket that I had with a retail assistant, and she was asking why I was buying so much candy. She thought it was for my children's birthday party, but I don't have children. So I kind of took this to extreme with what I really wanted to say but wasn't brave enough. It's between mealtimes, so I will cook a fry. Somebody has decided that breakfast plus lunch equals brunch, but I think lunkfast suits this meat-heavy meal better. I melt butter in the pan and cook sausages, rashers, and black pudding. The sausages hiss, and I'm glad. I like food that sounds like itself. I don't know when the black pudding is starting to burn, because black can't get any blacker. When the skin of the pudding has hardened, I heat the fry between two slices of white bread. The bread turns soggy with grease, a damp towel of a sandwich, but sog is good in food. I think of other black foods, burnt anything, licorice, black pepper, half a bull's-eye boiled sweet. Then I go through other coloured foods in my head until I'm struck with a plan. I will eat only blue foods for the rest of the day. I search the kitchen cupboards, but they are bare of blue, so I put on my coat. It's a heavy coat, packed with wool, and it feels like I'm putting on summer. I put my keys and some money in my bag, but it still seems empty, and I'm not quite sure what else to put in. I've seen women carry such big bags. What big lives they must have. So I take two books from the shelf and put them in my bag. Now I'm somebody who could pile six planets on her shoulders and carry them off. I bang the front door loudly when I leave the house to rouse the neighbours. I want to tell them about my plan, but no heads pop up from flower beds or peer out from behind doors. I walk to the supermarket, take a basket, and move slowly up and down each aisle. I feel like I've won a competition where the prize is blue food. I find blueberries, which are more of a nunnish navy, blue cheese, which smells of socks and tastes of wet dust, blue freeze pops in mouth-ripping plastic tubes, and a blue sports drink, the colour of an ambulance siren. I also pick up several multi-packs of Smarties and M&Ms, so that I can sift out only the blues. At the till, a heap of giddy rises up my throat. The shop assistant starts scanning my food. "Do you notice anything about my items?" I ask. It looks like she doesn't want to play my game, so I make it easy for her. "They're all blue." "Oh yeah, why?" "I'm having a blue party." The snarl on her face melts a little. "Is it her favourite colour?" she asks. "Whose favourite colour?" She looks confused. "Your little boy. Are these not for his birthday party?" I think for a moment. "Yes, they are, and I'm making a Smurf cake." The woman behind me in the queue pokes her head into the conversation. "Ah, that's lovely. What age is he?" "They're 6, I say. "I have boy twins." The words glide out of my mouth like a silk thread. "You must have your hands full with them," the woman behind me says. But the shop assistant only stares. "How come you never have them in here with you?" "Oh, I think for a minute." "They're in wheelchairs," I say. "Ah, God, that's terrible, terrible." "Who minds them?" asks the shop assistant. Her face is squeezed into strange shapes. "What?" I say. "When you come in here to do your shopping, who minds them?" "Oh," I say, "they're fine on their own." "You leave them alone?" Her voice sounds like a cup shattered on a tile. I look from one angry face to the other. "They can't get out of their wheelchairs," I say. "They're fine." They look at each other the way that girls in school used to look at each other, an eye lock that doesn't include me. Then they look at me with a purity of hate that stiffens me. I pack my blue items into my bag. I wish I'd remembered to bring a blue plastic bag, and pay. The woman behind me is muttering to the woman behind her, and I catch the words, "Social services, shouldn't be let have kids, something wrong with her." I take my change and hurry off with great big gulps of marbles in my throat. When I reach the house, I rush in, close the door, and bolt it. If social services come, they might be angrier that I'm not neglecting children I don't have if I was neglecting children I did have. I feel sadder than I've ever felt before, sad like the end of the world has come and gone without me. So that's an example of those kind of kind moments that start off with, you know, genuine kindness from other people, but then turn to awkwardness when Vivian takes it just a step or two too far.
She doesn't know what to say, so she makes up something really off the wall, as you say, and that gets her in trouble then.
Now, tell us a little bit about her search for a friend.
Yeah, so Vivian decides that she wants a friend called Penelope, and the reason is she wants to find out why the word Penelope doesn't rhyme with antelope. So she puts a notice up on a tree. So Vivian hasn't had a friend before, so she puts an ad up on a tree and then wanted friends called Penelope, and she makes it clear she doesn't want somebody who has shortened their name to Penny. It's only Penelope. And eventually somebody, she puts her phone number on the ad and somebody answers, and this person turns up and they become friends in a very unusual kind of friendship. I think Penelope is maybe not quite as strange as Vivian, but she's pretty close, I think.
Yeah, I would say she's pretty close.
Yeah, she has a mother with whom she's got a contentious relationship, and that kind of bothers Vivian, I think, doesn't it?
The mother, the contentious relationship?
Yeah.
Penelope's relationship.
Mother.
With her mother.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, and that brings out stuff with Vivian that I think she tries to repress about her own family.
Uh-huh.
And she can't deal with Penelope's. Penelope wants to talk about her contentious relationship with her mother, and Vivian just kind of shuts down. She can't deal with trauma, and ironically, I think Penelope thinks she's a great listener because she's kind of nodding and not saying anything. But Vivian has no clue of what she's being told.
Now, I think you indicated that you weren't really sure where Vivian was going to end up when you started writing.
Yeah. Exactly. So I thought of it in kind of episodes, or you know, her various walks where she comes home and maps the routes, or her different projects like eating blue foods for the day. But I hadn't thought of exactly where she'd end up or how she would develop as a character. And it took me starting to write it properly before I could kind of grasp where she was going to end up.
And how did that? How did you know, like, when the book was complete?
I think the developing friendship with Penelope helped me with that, because I had seen Vivian as probably more of a loner and somebody who acts completely alone and quite a negative. Or maybe she's not negative, but maybe the world reacted quite negatively towards her. And I felt it was quite a lonely existence. So I thought the book might have ended a bit more negatively. Originally, I thought, you know, things were going to get more and more lonely. But I needed to have another character, like another friend, basically, somebody to bounce things off. Because Vivian does exist in her head a lot. And I wanted more dialogue and more kind of attempts at interacting with the world, even if they didn't go smoothly. That she had to try and deal with people. So I think when I realised Penelope was on the scene, I thought there was hope then for a future for Vivian, like not in a romantic way, but just that she had somebody she could share things with. And I think it ends on a more hopeful note than... I know some readers have told me that they were dreading how it would end because, you know, anything could have happened to Vivian. And she's quite, like... She can get herself into difficult situations because she doesn't really think things through.
She's very innocent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, she comes across quite fairly rough or tough characters, and she doesn't always say the right thing. So I like that Penelope is with her, and kind of together they can take on the world.
So Penelope was kind of a surprise to you, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. I thought I would be dealing, because my research was all like Vivian and her walks and her projects. So yeah, exactly. I knew I was going to have her advertised for a friend, but I didn't realize the friend would become such a big part of her life. And I think Eggshells needed that. It would have been a bit too intense if you just had Vivian's thoughts all the time.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Katrina Lally, author of Eggshells, a novel. This novel's set in Dublin. It's very descriptive of Dublin.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you're inspiring, if this book will inspire tourists or even residents of Dublin to take some of these walks that you describe.
Yeah, I don't know. I love that idea of an eggshells tour, but I think people could be disappointed because, like, a lot of it is in Vivian's head. The actual places exist, but how she reads them is very much according to her. And partly that was great fun for me that year I was unemployed, because there was high unemployment in Ireland and in Dublin at the time, and a lot of businesses and stores were shutting, and the city just did seem quite bleak to me. Mm. So I loved that I could wander around Dublin with a notebook and see the city through these fresh eyes, quite childlike eyes. And so when I saw a little... I was in a clothing store one day and I saw a retail assistant opening a tiny door that I hadn't noticed, like about a, you know, one third or one quarter of the size of a regular door, and getting down on her knees and going through this door. And it led to a storeroom, but I thought, wow, this whole other world exists that I hadn't seen before. So I made a point of looking at Dublin through those, through fresh eyes, and tried to see it as a more magical place. So it might not be the most realistic interpretation of a city, and tourists could be disappointed if they don't find these magical things.
Let's talk about how you got published, because you said you never had published anything before. And so you wrote this book. It's an unusual book. How did you get to a publisher?
Well, I had seen an ad for this novel fair competition in the Irish Writers' Centre in Dublin. And the novel fair contest involved submitting 10,000 words and a synopsis by October. So it runs every year. And I thought, okay, that's a challenge for me. So I knew that I had to complete 10,000 words and a synopsis by the October deadline. And then the best thing about this contest was you didn't find out until the end of January if you had won or not, but you had to have completed a full novel by the end of January.
Oh.
So that was the perfect deadline. It meant that either way, whether you won the fair or not, you would have a finished novel. So this was perfect. I needed this external motivation to keep going. And luckily I won at place. There was 12 of us winners, and the prize was, it's kind of called speed dating for nerds. The prize was to meet with agents and publishers, to spend a whole Saturday in a room, and you sit at a table and you pitch your book to these agents and publishers, and then they switch places. Like a bell rings every 15 minutes and the agent moves off and you talk to the next agent and publisher. And it was an incredible prize. So from that, I got an agent immediately, and then a publisher came through a few months later. So it was an incredibly fast way to do things. I didn't have to kind of, you know, submit to that slush pile and wait months and months for publishers to get back to me. So it was really brilliant. And it's fantastic in Dublin when people ask me advice on getting published. I always tell them to enter this novel fair competition, because it's win-win as far as I can see. Like, and even I've known some people who didn't win the novel fair contest, but they still had a finished novel that they subsequently submitted and got published. So it's a great idea.
Now, it's the version of the book we have is published by Melville House. And is this a second publisher for the U.S., or was this your original publisher?
It was published by an Irish publisher in Ireland, okay. And then Melville House picked it up for the U.S.
Okay.
And that came about, it was a lovely story, just a bookseller in San Francisco got his hands on the book. It had no publishing deal in America. And then this bookseller, I think Martin Sorensen, he called Dennis Johnson in Melville House and said, oh, I think you might like this book. And Dennis and Valerie picked it up and published it. So I was thrilled with how it happened.
That's wonderful.
You just never know. You never know.
Is it being published in any other countries?
No, not yet. So we'll see. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. So I'm just trying to push ahead with writing the second book. So I think if you push ahead with the writing part, then you don't obsess too much about the the publishing deals that are or aren't happening.
And when was it published in Ireland?
It was 2015 in Ireland.
Okay, and then 2017 in the U.S.?
Yes.
Yes. And did you, so from the time you finished it like right at the January 31st deadline, or were you well done before then?
No, it was right at that January 31st, and that was 2014. So I just finished it in time for the novel fair in 2014.
Wow. And so then it took about a year or a little over a year from that point to actually reach the bookshelves, which is pretty fast.
Yeah.
And when you were, did you do any, have any editing done prior to that point, prior to when you pitched to the agents and publishers? Did you work with any editors on your own?
No, I didn't. I just worked myself and whittling away, like cutting the word count down. So it was really brilliant to have that 10,000 word limit, because it felt very doable to edit 10,000 words yourself. Whereas then when it came to kind of trying to edit the whole novel, I thought it probably was a bit looser towards the end, because I hadn't spent the same amount of time on the entire novel itself. I didn't at the time, I think. I was just concentrating so hard on those first 10,000 words.
So when you were writing the first draft at 1,000 words a day, that goes pretty fast.
Yeah. Now, I really tried for 1,000 words a day, but there were days it just didn't happen. And I think the problem with, I'm not doing that 1,000 words a day anymore, because the problem with that was I wrote like way too much, and it was trying to kind of hone this massive project into a workable novel. But that was a huge thing for me, to try and filter out which, like, Vivian went on a load more walks in the book, but that can get very tedious. So I was trying to figure out which were the strongest ones, or which made the most sense, or which pushed the novel forward a bit.
Because, as you saw
from reading it, it's not a strongly plot-based novel. So it could easily have gone onto a load of tangents, and so that was kind of my big problem, was to keep her kind of focused. And that's where Penelope helped too, just to kind of keep the human contact there.
Do you think you cut half of what you originally wrote?
I would say so, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, definitely. Some bits, like I said, I had that file of stuff I cut, but that was the good bits that I cut that I thought could be workable. And there's a lot of it was just deleted straight off, because it was, I suppose it felt like an exercise, like in just unleashing your imagination. But when you write 1,000 words, a lot of it isn't usable. It enabled me to get like an idea or two or a few paragraphs from the 1,000 words. It was what I needed to do to kind of open up the creative part of my brain. Right now, I'm not doing that at all. I'm a bit more focused, maybe because I saw how hard I had to work to edit and get rid of stuff from my first novel.
You know, it's interesting, because over the years, as we've talked to writers, there do seem to be two main schools in terms of writing process. And one is, like you said, you just write everything. You don't edit at all while you're going. You write as much and as quickly as you can, and then you go back and work it. But the other one is that you sort of write and edit at the same time. Now, the people who believe in the first method feel like that you need to turn your editing brain off to get the good stuff.
Yeah.
So how, now that you're kind of doing it in a more focused way, how do you make sure that you're not editing out the good stuff before you get it down on paper?
Exactly. That is my problem right now. And that's why this second novel is taking, I think it has taken me about 3 years or so, and I'm still not finished. There's something really joyful about just spilling everything from your brain onto the page and not judging yourself whether this is good or bad. It's a really hopeful way of writing, and not censoring yourself and not letting that judge in your brain kick in. I just couldn't do it this time around, and I miss it some days, because I think I'm, maybe because I have published a novel, I'm much more self-aware now of what works and what doesn't, or maybe I'm thinking too much about what critics will say or reviewers will say. I would like to get back, I think, to that 1,000 words a day, but it worked perfectly for me at the time. And I think maybe because it was my first novel, it felt like it was a lifetime of thought thoughts and stuff that had to go down on the page.
Yeah.
Whereas now, I'm just writing more carefully. That's not necessarily the best thing. I can't figure out. It'll be interesting when if I write a third novel, which approach or will I find somewhere between the two that works best.
Now, you said that you had saved all those notes that you about things that you didn't end up in the novel, right? You saved those notes.
I couldn't catch that.
Yeah. So, is that going to be another novel sometime? Or
she's asking if some of those parts that you cut, if you think you would be able to weave another novel out of those.
Oh yeah, I don't think so, because I would love to come back to Vivian in the future, and I think Vivian and Penelope's friendship could have a whole other life. But I don't think I will have her, Vivian, searching for a portal around Dublin. I just feel I've written about Dublin. I've done so much detail and research into it that I would love to put them in a new setting and have them explore somewhere different or have different motivations.
Yeah.
It's probably a file I should delete from my folder, because, I mean, you know, sometimes when you look at stuff afterwards, you're thinking, oh, maybe that's better than what I actually put in the book, and there's no point in having those kind of regrets.
You don't want to have to second guess yourself on that. That's what they call
Yeah.
What can you tell us about your second novel? Where is it set?
It's set in Hamburg in Germany. Kind of randomly, I was visiting a friend who lives there, and this was when I was just starting to kind of come up with my characters, but I knew that I did not want to set it in Dublin, because I've just spent so much time writing about Dublin. So I visited my friend in Hamburg and just loved the port area. They have a really fantastic port part of the city. Dublin is a port city, but the port is not that connected with the city. It's like a kilometre out, and we don't make as much of it as we could. But Hamburg, everything is kind of centred around the port, and it's our ports fascinate me. So I just picked that as a location, and it's about a brother and a sister. I wanted two narrators this time, because Vivian was very intense, and I wanted to kind of to make it a little less intense, to try and see the world through two different voices. So it's a man who lives in Hamburg, and his sister is coming over to visit him. And it's just the details of why he lives there and why she's coming to visit. And it's a lot of fun to do something different in location and narrator.
You know, when you study creative writing, there's, they talk about the sense of place, they talk about voice, they talk about tense, point of view, and it's really interesting to see how all of those have played out in your writing. Sense of place is obviously a very important part of Eggshells, and it sounds like it is also of your second book. Why do you think you're drawn to incorporating the place so much into your writing?
I think it's because I'm not hugely driven by plot. That plot isn't a massive feature of my books. I mean, I would love to be stronger at plot. I love reading those books where you just want to turn the page and see what happens next. But my books seem to be more about character, and I think maybe the character needs a strong setting. If you don't have a strong plot, I haven't really thought this through, but it seems like it needs something else. Like when I started off with Eggshells, and it was just Vivian walking around Dublin, like Dublin almost became another character to her, because everything she puts all her wishes and her hopes onto this city. And then maybe I just got used to writing about setting, I love reading books where setting is incredibly strong, and you don't have to have visited that city or that part of the world, but you get a real feeling for it. And I like that about a book.
I do too, and I think that's actually a very good observation, that a character-driven novel that doesn't have a strong plot needs a strong setting. to work.
As I was saying, and I was trying to think of examples, but I can't think of something to back up my point.
Yeah, but it just felt right. It definitely makes sense. Now, in terms of voice, obviously, that's, I got to say, the strongest element of the book is the voice. Vivian has a very unique voice, wouldn't you say, Caroline?
Yes, I would.
and it carries throughout the book. I did not notice any points where that lapsed.
No.
Now you write in, or this book is written in first person, present tense, which makes it very immediate, very intimate. Did you ever consider using a different tense or point of view?
No. From the start, it was very much first person. That came first because I was walking Vivian's walks myself. I needed to keep her in the first person so that I could kind of live through her. And then the present tense, as you said, it's the immediacy of it that appealed to me. And especially because there's so much that's happening right now. Like, she is walking. And I was kind of physically holding a notebook and writing as I was walking these walks. So it felt like past tense felt just too separate from it, or if I wrote past tense, I would have felt I had to analyze more or come up with more observations or think things through more, whereas the present tense just let me observe things, or let Vivian observe things without really judging too much. Or, like, I think for me the power of her was just the observation, the act of observing rather than analysing why this person is doing that. But I kind of left that to the reader to decide what other people's motivations were.
So you actually were Vivian sometimes then, right?
I was. I really was.
Yeah.
It was a strange time because she is quite an intense character, and it was hard for me to get out of that character. And even now, I will see street signs with different letters missing or just a jumble of words or interesting graffiti that Vivian would have loved. And it's hard for me to not write that in a notebook and think, oh, I should give this to Vivian.
Well, you know, I would be reading along and I would kind of, I know what this is. I know what this is about now. You know, I know where she's going. And then all of a sudden she would completely change. And then I would be, okay, we'll go down another path now, which made it interesting. It did.
Yeah, it's certainly a lot of you never know quite what to expect.
No, that's right.
Definitely. So, speaking of not knowing what to expect, did becoming a published author meet your expectations?
Yeah, it's still surreal to see your name on a book and to see your book in a bookshop. It's incredible. And it was a huge excitement for me when I got published in America, because I got to go over to Minneapolis and New York in January this year, which was incredible. This was like living the dream. I think anytime I go to a hotel room on my own, it's like, wow, this is a whole bed to myself and a TV. And so that part was really exciting. And I think, like, you probably know that, like, in Ireland, we really look to America, that, you know, so many Irish have gone over and emigrated, and that's kind of, for us, it's the big one to get published in America. So it was pretty huge for me.
Well, I would say it would be more exciting. I think you would find it more exciting to come to New York or Minneapolis when it's not January.
Yeah.
That's generally the worst month. I don't know. It may have been fine this year. We actually had a pretty mild winter in the Midwest.
Oh, boy.
So it may.
Really, was that mild? Oh, wow, you're hardy people.
And
it was a beautiful snowstorm when we were in New York, though. That was amazing. My partner came over I had a week of kind of meetings and publishing stuff, and then my partner came up to New York for a week of fun, and we had the most gorgeous snowstorm. So this was just gorgeous for us. We rarely get snow in Ireland, so it was a big deal.
Oh, wow. Oh, I bet it was, yeah.
Yeah.
Are you writing full time now, or do you still have a day job?
I'm working. I have a cleaning job in the mornings, so that suits my writing life really well. So early mornings, I work as a cleaner in Trinity College, where I used to study, which is quite interesting to see the place from a new angle. And then afternoons, I write.
Mm. And do you have a contract for the second book?
No, I don't. Which makes it kind of liberating, but also makes me lazier too about deadlines.
Because yes.
I'm not too hard on myself, and I'm expecting my first baby in 6 weeks' time.
Oh, so my goodness!
That's going to change things, I think.
It sure is.
I had big hopes to finish the second novel before the baby comes. So. Fingers crossed now. I'm really pushing out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Putting out all the stops for this.
Now, have you done readings in bookstores and so forth?
Yeah, I spent a lot of last year going all around Ireland. We have a lot of different very local book festivals and literary festivals and stuff held in bookstores and libraries. And that's a lot of fun, meeting people and answering questions. I mean, like talking to yourselves, it's lovely talking to people who have read the book and have really detailed questions about it, and just hearing other people's observations that things I had never thought about being brought up in relation to Vivian, which is really interesting. And funnily, when I went to America, people who had booksellers and librarians who had read Eggshells, a lot of them asked the question about PTSD. Does Vivian have post-traumatic stress disorder because of her traumatic childhood? And that was really interesting for me, because that's not something that came up in Ireland at all. Maybe because that's not on our radar so much yet. We're always a little bit behind, I think. Whatever happens in America, we're a few years. It happens in Ireland a few years later. So we don't have the same culture of it here, or awareness of PTSD. So it was really interesting seeing cultural differences.
I bet. Well, we're about out of time.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Katrina. Eggshells.
For having me. It was a lot of fun.
Eggshells is a delightful book. The use of language is incredible. It'll surprise you on every page.
Yes,
and
it will.
It's available wherever books are sold. Of course, we always highly recommend ordering through your local bookstore whenever possible. And thanks. And I hope you get your novel written before the baby comes.
Yes.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
And we look forward to hearing about it and reading it in a couple of years.
Brilliant.
All right.
I have a thing I want to end with today, because I think this really fits the people that she interacted with. If you can't be a pencil to write anyone's happiness, then try to be a nice eraser to remove their sadness. That's an unknown.
Stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild, and see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.